take honor of religion. Come on.
All right.
Oh, boy. I'm Haas, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And a little bit hard of hearing, obviously. You know, so it's been a little while since I've spoken in front of our group. You know, when I came here, I got here on September 12th, 2010. Barely had over a month of sobriety, almost a month of sobriety. My sobriety date is August 14th, 2010. And you know, it was a beginning. But to go back a little bit of what it was like, I was the kind of kid that never really fit in. You know, I was this skinny, poor Mexican kid, and wearing secondhand clothes or clothes that my mom sewed from patterns. And you know, I saw pictures of myself when I was about 6 or 7, and I go, "Wow, I would have picked on me." You know. It just, you know, it's just I had that look that said victim, I guess. And, you know, I spent some time living in Guadalupe and went to kindergarten there at that school. And my first experience with bullies was in kindergarten. And I tell you, girls are awful mean at that age. You know, I was just, they surrounded me, and they kicked me, and they teased me, and they tore my clothes, and it was just, they called me names, and wow, you know? And I'm going, where's the teachers?
Wow.
Yeah, you know, so it's pretty bad when girls pick on you. But, yeah. So, you know, that was my the beginning of my experience with the school bullies and not fitting in. It continued through elementary school up north. We moved and didn't change. Things didn't change. You know, first through sixth grade, getting picked on. I got really good at hiding. I got really good at volunteering in the office during recess. Or finding out who was on yard duty, and that's who I hung out with, the teachers. And of course, not having a lot of friends, I paid attention in class, and so I got good grades, and that made me even more of a target. So I'm not only the poor-looking kid, all skinny and scrawny and all this and that, wearing secondhand clothes still, I was also the nerd, you know. So I got, you know, I got good at it, but I wasn't perfect at it. Sometimes they would find me after school. The bullies would be on the same bus, you know. And that was just my life. And you know, the interesting thing was my dad was Filipino. So, you know, the old Filipino guys, they're like, "Be a man. Don't you cry. Don't be a girl. What's the matter with you, right?" And so after a couple of times of getting picked on, coming home and telling him, I stopped telling him. So I started making up stories. "Oh, I fell down at school. Oh, I fell down from the bus. Oh, I did this." So my mom started writing notes, and so I never had to do PE. You know, I mean, through high school, I never did PE. And it, you know, it continued through middle school, and it even continued in high school, the bullying. Because of course, they, you know, you follow your friends, right? You follow the kids; they just go to the next school, the next grade. So they got to be bigger, they got to be better at at knowing which buttons to push, what words to say, how to catch me. They knew me and how I tried to avoid them. So they got better at catching me. And I really got beat up a lot. And fortunately after that it was just mostly guys. Mostly. There's still a couple girls that were, they got better at being bullies too, you know? You know, and they got really tough. So that was my life for 12 years. 12 years and going home and having bruises and having torn clothes and making up stories of how it happened. So obviously there were no girlfriends during that time because who wants to date the nerd that gets beat up all the time, right? You know? So I kind of had one girl in late in high school, my senior year, that was a girlfriend. And she ended up breaking up with me. And so what do you do? Well, I remember that everything was life or death. You know, when you're young, man, it's drama. You know, it's all drama, you know. They cancel your favorite show. Oh, that's the end of the world. I don't know how I can go through without Gilligan's Island. It's the end of the episode. Yeah, I remember when it was not reruns. So, yeah, long time. Yeah. So she broke up with me, and what did I do? I looked for the nearest recruiter's office for the military. I'm leaving. Of course, having watched a lot of TV, I was looking for a Foreign Legion office. Thank goodness they didn't find that one. But I did find the Army. The Army recruiter. Yeah, that's right. Hoorah. That's right. And that was the beginning of a 9-year adventure in the Army. And I remember after my second week, I got called into the drill sergeant's office, and he goes, Diego. I said, oh, you're having a little bit of a hard time out there in PT. And I go, well, yeah, I didn't want to tell him that I've never done PE, never ran in my life except from the bullies, you know. And the only push-ups I got was to pick myself up when I got knocked down. So I was having one heck of a time. And he says, you know, we can send you home, and it'll be okay. It won't go on any record. And if later on you decide you want to try again, you can come back. And this was at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. We call it Fort Lost in the Woods, Missouri. And for good reason. And I was like, I don't want to go back home. I don't want to go back to that life. And so I said, no, I'm gonna do this. So he said, okay, and he gave me some pointers, what to do, extra exercises. By the time I got out of basic training, I wasn't a wimp anymore. Then I went to Fort Sam Houston, Texas for my medical training. I was a medic for 9 years. I got to be even more of a badass because I discovered I liked exercising. I loved it. So I started lifting weights and running with ankle weights for 10 miles, you know, and backpacks full of sand, you know, just to see, push the limit, right? Push the envelope. How much can I take? And so my mindset started to change. And later on, I realized, you know, I'm not a victim. And I started learning different things. You know, I learned weapons, of course, in the military. You learn different weapons. And I got to my first duty station, my first company commander down to my platoon sergeant. We're all airborne special forces. This is a medical unit. you know, cooks and ambulance drivers and mechanics and x-ray techs. And, you know, I got into that mentality of being tough, doing more. And so I got past the being a victim, and I started thinking, I'm a badass. I'm bad, you know? I went home on leave, and we went to the beach with me and my sister and my brother, and I took off my T-shirt, and my sister goes, damn, Junior, you're buffed. You know, I've never heard that before. No. And, I played trumpet in high school, too, so. Music and the chess club and the debate team. Hello. Target. You know, carrying a trumpet case and a briefcase in high school. Yeah. So, I was asking for it, I guess. You know, but, you know, I part of what I did was I learned how to be the toughest person I could be, because I'd grown up with a lot of fear, and but I didn't really realize what I was doing and why I was doing it until after I got to this program. But I'll tell you about that later. I got to be the baddest badass that I could be. I mean, I jumped out of airplanes with parachutes. Yes, with a parachute. I learned to use different weapons. I learned to throw knives. I learned martial arts. I learned, you know, jungle training, explosives, demolition, you know, and I was a medic. But I wanted to take every bit of training that I could get to be tough, because that was it. That was the mentality. If you're tough, you will survive and come back home. If you're not tough, you're not going to come back home. And that was drilled into me. So, but however, as a medic, I started to see things that, you know, only ambulance drivers and doctors and emergency rooms and all that see. People that are wounded so badly they're gonna die no matter what you do. People who have limbs removed, people who burn, and and you do things. So I learned that alcohol is a great coping mechanism. You know, if I have a bad day and I see some bad stuff, if I just have a few drinks, it's not so bad anymore. You know, I can sleep. I had a lot of nightmares when I first started. Part of it was because of the drill sergeants, but anyways. They didn't coddle us back then. You get off, and it's like the movies. You're the worst piece of shit I've ever seen before, and where are you from? You're from California. You must be a steer or a queer. You know? So, all that, you know? Bottom of the barrel, you know, all that stuff. And so I learned to drink. And my first sergeant was in the habit of, it's Friday afternoon, we just got released, you worked hard, if I see you here any time during the weekend, you got KP. Which means peel 1,000 potatoes, cut a 500 onions, whatever. It was not fun. And it was a lot of work. And it was dirty work because there was a lot of greasy pans and stuff. And so I would take that mentality and I would go and party. You know, and sometimes, one time we were in the middle of nowhere, and so we had this cough syrup in the military, and we used to call it GI gin. You know, it was like 80 proof. And of course, being a medic, I was in a part of an ambulance crew. And so we're, three or four of us were sitting in the back of Memphis, because it was about 20 degrees below zero outside, so we didn't want to hang out outside. So we had the engine on and the heater going and everything, and we're chugging. We got a case of this GI gin. It was about 40 bottles of it between the four of us, and we're drinking, we're chugging, and we're also taking hits off of nitrous oxide. So we're drinking, and we take a hit, and as we're handing it, we're going, everything was funny. We didn't have to talk, and it was funny. You know, and so we're having it, and we're doing that, and the first sergeant, all of a sudden the doors to the back of the ambulance open up, and the first sergeant goes, "What the hell is going on back here, bud?" We didn't think, let's see, the engine's on, so the exhaust is going, making a big old steam cloud, and then the exhaust for the heater is on, so that's another steam cloud. Yeah, we didn't think it was funny after that. We got in a lot of trouble. But, you know, that was the kind of things we did to cope. If alcohol or beer wasn't there, or other things. You know, whatever would make this go away and my thinking would change and I could mellow out a little bit and forget about stuff just for a little while, then that's what I did. You know, I don't know how much weed I smoked. But that was there. So it was that and drinking and alcohol, hard liquor. After a while, it had to be hard liquor. Because beer didn't work anymore. I could drink a case of beer and not even catch a buzz. But I was drinking a handle of vodka a day. Some people, like my cousin here, remembers those days. Whew! Yeah. Crazy days of me coming to visit after I got out and drinking, and I'd wake up the next morning and they had moved me into the garage because I was snoring so loud. They could have moved me into the street and I would have known. You know, I was done. I was out. You know, when you drink that much that fast. So, yeah, I drank a lot, you know, and to forget. And so, however, the fun stopped, I found. There were days when I didn't remember what I had done. There was a lot of days, actually. I woke up one time, I started out drinking in California and woke up in Nevada, married to a woman I didn't know. Yeah, don't remember driving there, don't remember meeting her, don't remember getting married. So, yeah, that got annulled really quick. That day. I've had three divorces. I've got 9 baby mamas, got 12 kids and 4 stepkids. I was busy. I made up for all that lost time. You know? But you know, it's when you're drinking, you know, you're like, oh, she's so pretty, she's cool, but you know what? I found out the girls go, yeah, you're handsomer too. You know, you're handsomer when they're drinking, we're handsome. You know, and then they wake up and they go, who the hell is this guy? Woo! Yeah. So you know, it progressive disease, just like the big book says. It turns into a cycle. And for me, it became a cycle of where it was just hours that I would start out sober, I would start drinking, and then black out. One time I was thinking it was going to be my 33rd birthday. And I'm going, yeah, I'm going to be 33 this year. And my ex-wife, my third ex-wife, said, you need to do the math. What year is this? And I go, set it up. And she goes, okay, when were you born? And I go, oh, shit, I'm going to be 35. What happened to those 2 years? You know, a lot of blackouts. a lot of backups. Also, there was a lot of arguing with these women. Anybody who's been married as an alcoholic, and especially married to a fellow alcoholic, whew, that's like fire and gasoline, man. You know, I could see in their eyes when they'd had just enough and something would click. It's like the pupils would go, meow. And I knew, I better find someplace to lock a door. You know? Oh, man, you think women are the gentler sex? No, buddy. No. As a medic, I guarantee you, there are more domestic violence deaths caused by women than there are men. Because women will pick something up. They hit you with something. Guys, we go like this. And they go, oh, hell no. And they grab something. You know? And they're going to kill you. Because they know if they don't, they're going to get hurt. They see all the women are going, Be careful. You know? So, the argument, the constant arguing, day in and day out. And the worst part is raising kids around that environment. You know? My two oldest had to put up with having to separate us from each other. And I remember the oldest at the age of maybe 8 would drag his mom. He's 6'10", so he was a big kid. He's 6'10" now, not at 8. No, but he was a big kid, and he would drag his mom into one room, and then the other one would drag me into the other one and say, come on, Dad. And he would sleep in front of the door so that we couldn't get out and get to each other again. What kind of life is that as a kid? Then you go home. Then you go to school. And go, oh, what'd you do yesterday? What'd you do this weekend? Well, I kept my parents from killing each other, you know, and so it just kept getting worse, this cycle, this downward spiral that I had, and it ended up with, at the age of 50, was my last year, 50 till I was 51, my last year of drinking, and I was drinking 1.5 to 2 half gallons of vodka straight 7 days a week. I was drinking around the clock because if I didn't drink at least a pint every 2 or 3 hours, I would have seizures. So I didn't have a choice anymore. I couldn't not drink. And you know, the pain of waking up and needing a drink and the physical dependence on it was so bad, I would have rather had those bullies beat me up 10 times. I hurt everywhere. It was nothing but pain. And, you know, and of course, the family's done with me. My kids don't want to talk to me anymore. My wife didn't want to talk. My ex-wife didn't want to talk to me anymore. Didn't even want me sleeping in the same room. Nope, my life became this part of the living room couch. That's it. I wouldn't shower for days. Wouldn't always make it to the bathroom. So the only difference between me and the drunk that you see sleeping in on the sidewalk, you know, with pee and feces and everything in his clothes, was I had a house to do it in. Woohoo. So, you know, I went to hospitals trying to ask to get some help, get detox. And I remember one nurse looking at me, and I told her, as they started the IV, she said, hold still. And I go, I can't stop shaking. And she looked at me, and she had her clipboard, and she goes like this, and she goes, well, of course, look what you've done to yourself. And she turned away and left. That's how tall I felt. So I had no more friends. they wouldn't admit me in a hospital. I went to almost every hospital in 100 miles. And so I was done. Daily pain, drinking 24/7. It didn't matter what time it was. When I woke up, I knew I had a drink. And I would take, I was drinking out of the red solo cups. I'd take the bottle of vodka and go like this and squeeze it till it was full. And then I'd drop a straw in it and I'd go like this, because until I drank that first cupful, I couldn't hold the cup without spilling it. After about a year of that, I decided everyone would be better off without me, you know? And I called my kids on the phone and I told them goodbye. And I, in a manner where I didn't really want to let them know, I just said, you know, in case anything ever happens to me, I want you to know that I've tried to be the best dad that I ever could. And my son tells me now, he says, thanks, Dad, I just quit smoking and I started right up again. Yeah. He says, you stressed me out. And of course, the kids started coming to the house and visiting me, because up until then, they didn't want to. But they were checking, and I didn't notice until later, they were taking turns. You know, you check on Dad today, and then I'll check on him tonight, and then blah, blah, blah. And I'd be there, and they'd try and feed me. And, of course, I wasn't eating except maybe every 3 or 4 days. I'd have, like, a cup of noodles. And that was all I could, that's all I could hold down. So after a couple of weeks, though, they stopped checking on me. So I decided, okay, now's the time. And I picked 5 o'clock in the morning. I was, of course, again, living in the living room. And I took my pistol and I loaded it. And I sat there with my half gallon of vodka, because I had to drink, otherwise I would probably missed, you know. Yeah. You know? And I was looking at the clock, just waiting for the time to come. And, you know, I got to the point where that time, for me, I looked at it as being a release. I was finally going to be done. The pain would be over. And people could go back on with their lives. But obviously I didn't do it. But 10 minutes before 5, I heard a voice. And the voice said, you don't have to die. I was alone. And I looked around. And there wasn't anybody there. But then my son called me. And he said, I found a detox that'll take you. A hospital, actually. He said, but you got to go now. I was admitted to the hospital. And it was funny, I told the doctor, I said, I don't have any insurance. And he looked at me and he says, your life is worth more than money. Wow. I've never, ever come across another doctor that told me that, unfortunately. Now they all bill. You know? I went through the detox process of medications. I don't remember anything for the first 5 days. And then, I remember I had a big bottle of vodka, a water bottle that I'd filled up with vodka, but it was the big one, the smart water. Yeah. I was walking around the emergency room drinking that, waiting for them to call my name. Because every 2 or 3 hours, and if you've ever been in an emergency room, sometimes it takes longer. And I didn't want to have a seizure, right? Not at a hospital. Yeah. You know, thinking wasn't all that great. So when he said, okay, we're going to meet you, I told him I didn't have any money, and he told me that. I went up, they started going through my things, they go, oh, here's your water, where do you want me to put it? And I go, oh, that's not water. She opened it up, and she goes, whew, and I go, I don't need that anymore. And you know what? That was the release of the obsession. I have never wanted to drink again. Yeah. You know, and it was like a huge weight was lifted off my shoulders. So there I am, and I'm done. And for different reasons, because I realized that my ex-wife wasn't going to get sober with me, I came here. I left my wife on September 11th. I'll always remember that day. Not because of the World Trade Centers and all that, but because I left a 24-year relationship. And that's hard. That's pretty much all I knew as an adult. But I came here, and I found a new family in AA. People like, well, Chyna, who is family. Jim and Keith, who called himself Louie half the time, and you know, and so many other people, you know. And Terry, my wonderful sponsor, who threatened to pistol whip me if I didn't listen to him, or shoot me. He said, I'm gonna think about it. I'll make up my mind by the time I get to your house. So we were gonna go. He wanted me to go to barbecue. Obviously, I went to the barbecue. Yeah, because I didn't want to take the chance. Plus, I didn't have any guns. So, you know, so I came here, and I went to my first meeting at this place, 1600 Club, the Happy Hour. My cousin Butch, who is the one who showed me where this meeting was, and he's right there. With a rhino style hat. Thank you. And I was desperate. And I knew I was desperate. And I knew I had to do this. So I started coming to meetings. I went to 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week for the first year. I lived, ate, and breathed AA. If I wasn't here, I was at home reading the big book. If I wasn't home reading the big book or sleeping, I was here. That was it. I was the first one here and the last one to leave because I knew I was safe here. If I did this, if I took it serious, it wasn't a game anymore. You know, drinking wasn't fun anymore. Drinking was the end of my life. That's what was going to happen. I knew that. You know, I was by a thread, man. I was hanging on by a thread. And by working the program wholeheartedly, thoroughly, like the big book says, you know, thoroughly, and I remember that because I had gone before because I had been told to by my ex-wife that she was going to leave. I was spousal ordered. Yeah. And more in a court, more than a judge. It's worse than a judge because you don't go home and the judge is there, you know? So, yeah, again, worse than getting in a fight with a guy, you know? But I didn't take it serious. As soon as she stopped nagging, I stopped going. As soon as I stopped going, I started drinking. And I was right back. It took me 10 years to get back here, and I almost died. I explained to you how it felt. So I came here, I knew I was an alcoholic. Step one was easy. I knew I was an alcoholic. My life, unmanageable? What life? I didn't have a life anymore. You know, I was a shell. You know, I had ended up doing things that I swore I would never, ever do. You know, and it got to be that the more I did them, the less it mattered. It got to be really easy, you know. I didn't care. You know, if you had what I wanted, I would take it, one way or another. I remember rolling drunks as they're coming out of a bar, you know, with a 2x4. Didn't matter. I knew when payday was. I'd go there and I'd roll them over. You know, I'd knock them out and I'd take their money. And these were the guys that I knew that didn't like banks, so they'd keep their money in their pocket. So take their whole roll, you know. I never worried about accidentally killing somebody. So I came here and I knew my life was unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, you know? That voice. That voice, the doctor admitting me without warning, and you know what? I never got a bill, so he was serious. 6 days in the hospital, in a private room. Then I found out it was a psych ward. beside the point, you know? I remember finally after 5 days looking outside my room, and I go, what do they mean, fall risk? You know, and then I went back to my room, like this. You know, I knew power greater than myself was the only thing that was going to make me sane again. Made a decision to turn my will over to the care of God as I understood Him. Guess what? I had tried for years. At the age of 51, I couldn't think of any new ideas. You know? Didn't, and friends had always tried, do this, do that, just drink beer, just drink wine. Well, you know what, no matter what you're drinking, if you drink enough of it, you know? So, I had to find a good sponsor. And my sponsor is Terry over there. And this man wasn't going to take no crap. You know, I am dead serious, you know? I was looking around and I heard him say, he used to be a Hell's Angel. And I said, okay. It was either him or Jim. Jim scared me. Yeah. I kept waiting to go out and see him with a pickup truck with a shotgun rack on his gun, in his truck, you know? And that's what I thought of him. And I was like, it also pissed me off because you smiled all the time. I was like, there ain't nothing to smile about, damn it. I'm sick. Well, you were all happy and everyone laughing. Oh. And if I wasn't so sick, I would have kicked your ass. I used to say that to myself. Yeah, when I get better, that's what I used to say. I'm going to kick his ass. Funny, as I got better, he got better. He didn't bother me no more. You know? So I got a good sponsor who not only didn't put up with my shit, but knew the program. And there's others in here, you know, men and women that know the program. It's a simple program. If I surrendered, I had to surrender. I had to get beat to hell because I was a badass, right? So I had to get beat up so bad that nothing else, I knew nothing else was going to work, you know? And, so I got the sponsor, did what he said. That moral inventory stuff for him, man, that took me 6 months, I think. Whew! And you know what? It's in pieces, and it's just trying to be thorough again. Because I had done the not thorough thing. I had done the pretend steps, you know? And you know what? I almost died. I almost took my own life. And I destroyed everything that I knew and loved. 1 year I had 14 W-2s, by the way. And I thought, hey, I'm good at getting jobs. Just wasn't good at keeping them. So I did the fourth step, you know, and doing it one piece at a time, just like it says. Instead of jumping around, then I did the fifth step. And, you know, there's crying. There's crying involved, but it's a cleansing. There's anger, there's fear. Every emotion that I used to try and cover up came to the surface when I got sober, as I started to do this program. And it just, you know, but fortunately there's men and women that are in this program that want to take care of you, and all they want to do is see me get better and see you get better. If you're willing to do the work. Is it work? It's hard. Because I spent most of my adult life not living life like that. You know, nobody tells me what to do. Nope. I'll do what I want. I remember walking out the door and looking up in the sky and going, yeah, I know it's wrong. I dare you to stop me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He said, no, I'm just going to let you kick your own ass. It would have been so much kinder if he had stopped me way back when. You know? So then, step six, you know? Now entirely ready to have God remove all the defects of character. That doesn't mean he's going to remove them. I just had to be ready for him to remove them. I didn't get that for a while. I'm like, okay, I did the step. I'm perfect now. No. Nope, still not. Hello. Wife number four will tell you that. I'm not perfect, not by a long shot. But she doesn't, you know, there was a time when I thought my name was asshole. Not anymore. Now I know it's hoss. Or sweetheart. Or honey. You know? Yeah. Or other names that I'm sure some of us have been called. Yeah. Yeah. The worst thing is when they sneak up on you and they don't say a word. All you know is your head hurts afterwards. Or you wake up and you got blood on your face. You're going, how'd that happen? I don't know. You came home that way. Yeah. I don't know. You know, so I did the sixth step. The seventh step, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, the shortcomings are in this other big book, you know, greed, lust, sloth, those. All those things that when I started drinking became inflated. Pride. Oh, my gosh. I used to be the kind of guy that would walk down the worst part of town that was almost all African-Americans and say, and yelling out at the top of my voice, I hate... Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And I dare him to come down. Of course, I had a pistol right back here, but, you know. And probably they thought, heck, guy's crazy. Don't go down there. Just let him keep going. He's insane. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, but that's the kind of stuff I used to do, crazy. And so my short, everything was just blown out of proportion. Making the list of the people I had harmed and became willing to make amends, I was told, thankfully, by my sponsor, that unless it would injure them or others. Now, I was one of the others. So I don't go and say, I slept with your wife 10 years ago. No, you know, don't do that, you know. There's a few of those. Boy, all sense of good judgment just would fly out the window, right? And then, of course, I'd make the direct amends and, you know, skip the ones that would kill me or them. 10, 11, and 12 are what keep me focused. You know, at the end of the day, I think about what I've done during the day, and that's my personal inventory, and if I was wrong, I try and go and I apologize or I make up for it because I don't want to keep adding to the crap that I had to carry most of my life. And then I have to, and 11, of course, is daily, on a daily basis, I have to try and, instead of think of my will, think of God's will. And my God is the God in the other big book. And, you know, even though you guys aren't around, he still sees what I do. So, yeah, you know, so it keeps me focused a little bit better. And then, of course, 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, I've got a sponsee, Chris, over here. And I made a few mistakes as a sponsor and got fired a couple of times because I didn't know how to do it. There's no manual, hello, on how to sponsor. I tried to do it. But, you know, I try and live my life in a way that I don't continue to harm the ones around me and the ones that I love. you know. I try and treat others the way I would like to be treated. I try and be a man of my word. And if I can do something, I don't promise that I'm going to do something. I say, well, let me see what I can do, you know, and that's what I have to do. Because, you know, crap is not fun to carry around. And, you know, I had a friend that was in the program, and he'd look at all of the cholos, you know. Look at all the cholos. He goes, oh, yeah, you're a tough guy, huh? And they'd be like, he said, if you're so tough, don't drink for a year. Ooh, and they'd be like, you know, that's hard. Don't drink for a year. Don't lie. Don't lie for a week. That would have been hard for me. Shh, a day. You know? This program has given me so much. These people, all of you in this room, I have either been examples of what it's like out there still, for those of you who like to relapse. I'm glad you made it back in, because, you know, if you don't make it back in, we've buried a lot of people here in the rooms that don't make it back in. And it's not that hard to die from this disease. Sometimes it's slow, though, and that's hard. If you ever see anyone dying from alcohol, poisoning of their liver and their kidneys, it's a slow process, man. This thing can kill you over a period of years. And I lost my usefulness way, way before I was ready to end it. So, you know, if you're new, and I just hope you can at least try to take this serious. We laugh a lot in these rooms, and we have a lot of fun, you know. We tease each other, you know. And, yeah, there's some of us that are still sick, and, you know, sometimes we don't always know what we're saying. We might not say the right thing, you know, and sometimes people like Billy will say the right thing to someone who's made a mistake and they're new, you know. But we learn to be gentle to others and hard on ourselves. Be tough. I learned to be tough with me, you know, because I have to stay sober. If I don't stay sober, I can't do anything, you know. I've been here almost 7 years now, and next month, my lovely wife and I are moving out of state to beautiful Northwest Arkansas. I see smiles and I see shock, you know. It's for us, that seems the path that our God is pointing us to. It's a Bible Belt. We want to start a ministry. And I've got all of the schedules for the meetings. And I already contacted one of the guys. And so I got their phone numbers. And you know what? I know I'm always going to be an alcoholic, whether I drink or not. As long as I don't drink, I have a chance. I get a daily reprieve, okay, based on my spiritual condition. And if I stay connected, you know, I'm grateful for all of you who are in here, for those of you who were here since I first got here and have helped me along in my crazy days. I cried a lot. I was known as, was it Mr. Burning Desire? That's right. That was me, Mr. Burning Desire, Captain Burning Desire. Oh, there's up. And when they'd say, are there any burning desires, everybody's head would turn to me. Sometimes they still do. You know, thank you to everybody, you know. AA is such a beautiful program. I hope you give it the chance that it deserves. I hope it gives you the chance you deserve. You know, God doesn't make mistakes. You know, we're not bad people. We're good people with a bad problem. Thank you very much.
She will be available after the meeting, and just go ahead, she's willing to help clean up areas. All right, can I, ladies, get up?